Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Hope everyone in your orbit is doing okay, keeping well, keeping healthy, safe and sound of body and mind. It can be tough going. So wherever you are and whatever you're doing and whoever you're with, I hope everyone is doing okay. It helps, I suppose, if you're listening to this, that Arsenal win football games. That's always nice. It helps alleviate some of the other stresses and strains and everything else. You know, you can say, look, it's only a game. In the grand scheme of things, there are more important things in the world. Of course there are. Of course. But, you know, it does affect your mood when you support a football club and the football club that you support doesn't do as well as you would like it to do. So when it starts to do better than it was doing, if not still as well as you would like it to do, it just makes life a little bit better. And I think we could all use whatever makes life a little bit better at this moment in time. What was I going to say? I don't know. I don't have a great deal to say in the opening part of this particular podcast because we're going into an FA Cup weekend. We've got two games in a few days against Southampton. I don't know how you feel about these things, these sort of double headers when you play a team in a cup and in the league or in the old days. Remember when you play a team in the cup and you draw and there'd be a replay and there'd be a number of replays. I remember when I was growing up, there was maybe four games in a row against Liverpool in the FA Cup. This season, of course, there are no replays because of everything else that's going on and what have you. But back then, you didn't just have one replay and then penalties. It was a replay. And then another replay and another replay. I think we played Liverpool four times. Could have been 1980. I remember listening to those games on the radio as a 9 or 10 year old, thereabouts anyway. And Leeds as well at some point in the 90s. Did we play Leeds a load of times in one go? And perhaps Sheffield Wednesday? I can't remember. But anyway, it doesn't tend to happen as much these days, but we do have two games coming up against Southampton, Saturday and Tuesday. So towards the end, I will talk a little bit about the team that we might pick for the FA Cup game, given that we are going to need to rotate, and there are reasons why we want to do that, not just to keep players fresh, but to try and get some players back towards some kind of form match fitness / effectiveness or whatever it might be. So we'll do that towards the end of the podcast, but we might as well just crack on into this. And it's been an interesting few weeks for Arsenal. We're going to talk about that, the games we've won, some of the positives, some of the players that have come through. But I thought we might talk about something a little non-Arsenal first with my guest today. He is the football correspondent for CBS. It's James Bench. Hello, James.
Hi, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. We are going to talk Arsenal. There are some interesting bits and pieces, and obviously the last few weeks have been quite good from an Arsenal perspective, perhaps giving us a platform, things to build on as we go forward to a more difficult and challenging run of fixtures. We'll get to that in good time. But I wanted to talk to you just a bit about the James Maddison interview this week that he did with Sky Sports after their 2-0 win over Chelsea. Very good result for Leicester. Put them top of the league, I think. Maddison scored a goal. And he spoke on Sky Sports afterwards and spoke, I thought, pretty well. He expanded on certain things that you don't necessarily hear footballers talk about a great deal. But there was this big not furore, but there was a lot of hype about this. It was like, oh my God, what a brilliant interview. This is an amazing interview with James Maddison. And I'm not saying he didn't speak well, and I'm not saying it wasn't interesting, but my contention is that it was highlighted because in general, post-match interviews with footballers are paint-by-numbers, very bland. Say, you know, answer the questions. Yeah, it's a game of two halves. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the ball came in and hit it in the back of the net. You know, that kind of stuff. That they're in comparison to all the stuff that we normally get, this stood out, not because it was super brilliant in its own right, but because it was just a lot better than all the usual crap.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I think the big thing for me is he told us things that we didn't know. And then, you know, we actually got a degree of understanding of how Leicester had gone about winning a football match. And this, I really want to emphasize, none of this is criticizing the interviewers in these situations, because it's hard. And, you know, we can sort of address why. But, I mean, what I liked about it was I got an understanding of how Leicester had gone about winning a football match, which when you think about it, that is the whole purpose of these flash interviews after the game, especially the ones for broadcasters that kind of, you know, run straight after during the match analysis. We want to know what Leicester got right. And, you know, talking about how they'd worked specifically on short corners and how they'd worked on their system, you know, what they'd be in possession and out of possession. That was something that, you know, that stood out to me as something we don't get, that it doesn't really make any sense not to get. I think there's such, across the football landscape, there's such a hesitancy to actually talk about the game that is being played. And I think that is why we kind of end up gravitating towards some quite bland and quite consistent lines of questioning about everything but the way in which the sport gets played, which I don't really enjoy anymore. I think I want to shout him out before I forget. My former colleague, Art de Roche at The Athletic, is really good in press conferences at doing the same thing, asking questions about football. So often it's not about that. And I think what was exciting was Maddison addressed this without fear of giving away tactical insights, without fear of, you know, revealing his plan, Rodgers' plans to the next opponent. And he just sort of told us things we'd like to know. It stood out. And as you say, when you think about why it stood out, it ought not to be remarkable. He's very similar to every other footballer who you speak to. They're a smart, eloquent guys. I think that a lot of the time they're just coached to not say anything that interesting or revelatory.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things that occur to me. One is that, okay, you mentioned it, and we know that young players at football clubs, when they're coming through, they are coached, as you say, but they're taught. They have classes in media training, like what to say, what not to say. You know, because obviously football clubs don't want to deal with you know, a player saying something and it becomes a scandal, or it becomes a, you know, a huge issue. They'd rather not deal with those things. You know, they've got enough going on in general without having to sort of firefight situations like that. So as much as possible, they're giving these players, you know, the tools, if you like, to deal with the questions that they're being asked in an interview. So if you get a difficult question, you know, you give them a sort of platitude in return, and it sort of dampens down any potential outbreak of fire that might come from it. But there's another part of this, I think, as well, which is that we exist in, and we are part of, and I think we have to acknowledge that as people who talk and write and speak about football with the regularity and frequency and perhaps monotony that we do, we have to take our part in that. But we live in this media landscape, which is, I think, leaning more and more towards these kind of, if you like, gotcha moments. So one little slip and you become a meme. You know, you're people out there, everything is permanent. There's no sort of getting away from, right, you say this and it's just sort of going to go away in a day or two. It exists forever. There's a permanency about everything that everybody says on the internet. So does that in some ways lend itself to these kind of bland interviews, because nobody wants to say something controversial or something that's going to exist and basically follow them around forever and ever?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you kind of remember back to 10 or so years ago, however long it was, when, you know, the prime example for me that always I remember is AVB, what were the words he said about Arsenal? That it was a negative cycle.
Negative spiral, yeah.
And that is, you know, that is a question you cannot escape. And, you know, I think managers, players live in fear of having their words continually relayed back to them and saying, you said this last month. You know, what do you mean by it? I thought we saw a prime example of this in the press conference earlier, where Mikel Arteta, probably a few months ago now, had lost his cool a little bit when discussing the leaks coming out of the Arsenal dressing room. I think it was in relation to the David Luiz, Danny Ceballos bust up, for want of a better word. And he, you know, he kind of came out and said, I'm going to fire and brimstone, or as near as Arteta gets to it, saying, I'm going to find out who this leaker is. And, you know, I'm gonna come down on them like the wrath of God. I'm paraphrasing the last bit. And then all credit to James Ollie, he brings that back kind of out of the blue in today's press conference. And it's suddenly Mikel Arteta's kind of having to manage what he said before.
Yeah, you could see him thinking, couldn't you? He was like, ah, oh, fuck.
And exactly. And no one wants to be putting that much, you know, effort into press conferences. They'd rather be, you know, straight batting transfer questions and, you know, offering platitudes to outgoing players. Yeah, I think there's a real fear of your words coming back to haunt you. And you find this when you interview players as well, that, you know, it's pretty rare now to have a conversation with people and not at least agree to let them see some copy beforehand, I must admit. You know, I've done that and I don't like doing that, but it's the game we play. I think it is a real fear of something you said 3 years ago being thrown back in your face. I think we see that with, you know, on Twitter so much. Whenever there's an Arsenal press conference, someone will, within 15 minutes, will grab something that Arteta said 3 months ago and go, oh, well, 3 months ago he said this. Why is he saying this now?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's almost as if circumstances and opinions and points of view can change. I mean, remarkable, I know. But, you know, coming back to the interview side of things, you know, you've been there in mixed zones and things like that. You know, do these opportunities to speak to players lend themselves inherently to interesting things, in that if a player stops and talks to you guys after a defeat, you know, there's an element of, I remember it was Johan Juru for years and years and years, you know, whenever things went wrong for Arsenal, Johan Juru was the guy who would say, well, you know, we've, again, paraphrasing, we've got to learn from this, we've got to do better, work harder on the training ground, et cetera, et cetera. Because, like, what else is there to say after a defeat other than to say, well, look, this wasn't good, we'll try and put it right. There's only so many ways you can say that. You can't be scathing about your colleagues. You can't be critical of the manager's tactics, not if you want to play in the next game. And when you win, it's like, well, yeah, it's great. It's a, you know, boost of confidence. It's good for the lads, you know, back to winning ways, et cetera, et cetera. So in, you know, in those circumstances, how difficult is it as a journalist, as a reporter, to ask a question of a player that is going to give you anything above and beyond what we have become so used to?
So I suppose the cop-out answer is it depends on the player.
Yeah.
I was certainly, you know, Arsenal still have a great heritage of having the odd guy that has to go in the mix zone after every defeat. You know, I think we all mentioned this on Twitter yesterday. The real hammer blow of losing Sokratis is that means Bernd Leno now has to do all post-match 2-0 defeat mix zones. It's a real challenge talking about football in such a speedy, you know, speedy way. We have like 3 minutes. There's normally, I mean, you know, I probably won't be doing these even if they return afterwards, nature of the job. There's five or six people huddling around. We all have different ideas of what we want to get out of whatever player we get, and you don't always know which player's going to talk to you until they stop and talk to you as they're walking past. And I mean, you certainly know some players that won't stop, but you know, someone like Aubameyang might take you by surprise and be in the mood to talk one time, and then you've got to kind of think of something interesting to say. You know, you're almost live, because you don't just want what happened in the game. You know, by the time you come to use these quotes, the game's long gone in the past, and this is Arsenal and the world moves very quickly. So yeah, from that side, it's a challenge to find interesting things. Equally, if you can hit on the right topic, you know, you do discover that actually most players are just like James Maddison was the other night. I remember really well talking to David Luiz after a 0-0 against Burnley last season, and it was either just after Mari had signed or it was so close to signing that everyone in the club was talking openly about it. And we spent a good 4 or 5 minutes chatting about Flamengo and, you know, how Mari had got on and Jorge Jesus and how Luis would help Mari when he arrived. Mm. I mean, there was some remark. It was myself, Charles Watts and Simon Collings. And I have to say, there was some exceptional bullshitting over the level of Brazilian football knowledge we all shared, because I don't think any of us had a clue. And we're going, oh, yeah, Flamengo, good team to play, you know, play football in the right way. Between us, we'd probably seen 0 minutes of Flamengo.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's hard to find the right topics, because, as you say, the players are really worried about being seen to criticise the manager, being seen to question tactics or how they're being used. And then after, you know, after a win or after a morale-boosting win, you kind of don't want to fall down the road of platitudes of, you know, this is a turning point. Because the truth is, fans now are so media savvy that they don't read that. You know, no one's interested at all in someone saying on a Monday at midday after a Saturday 3-0 win over Southampton that, you know, this is a real building block for Arsenal season. No one cares. You've got to try and move things on. So it's a challenge, but, you know, ultimately that's what they pay us money to do, and a lot of people would do it for free.
For sure. You know, on that then, and this isn't sort of specific to Arsenal or anything like that, do you feel, you know, not personally, but sort of generally, that if there were a bit more access outside of these post-game scenarios, or, you know, the sort of European press conferences where there's the manager plus a player, you know, those are really the only times you get any kind of access to a player, unless they're doing something like, you know, they're launching something with one of their sponsors, and you get a bit of sort of almost like mix zone access to a player in those sort of circumstances, where seven journalists have got an exclusive with the one player and all the answers are the same kind of thing, you know. You know, are clubs kind of afraid in some ways to expose the players? I mean, it strikes me, look, some players just don't want to do it, don't want to talk, don't want to really speak to the press. And that's fair enough. I can understand why that might be the case. Some of them just maybe aren't comfortable with it. They don't feel like they've got anything to say. Others might be concerned that what they do say could be taken out of context, et cetera, et cetera. But there must be others who are willing and happy to talk about the game and talk about themselves as players and talk about situations that they find themselves in. It's a difficult balance, isn't it? Because, you know, quite often, you know, whether you're fighting relegation, whether you're challenging for the title, whether you're battling for a top four spot, battling for a European spot, trying to stay in a cup, whatever it is, there's a sort of delicateness to every scenario that a football club and a player might find themselves in. So, you know, maybe better access or more unrestricted access to players could give us more insight and more interesting stuff. But I understand at the same time why clubs are reluctant to do that.
Yeah, and of course they've got, you know, they've got media arms of their own to feed. I remember speaking to the agent of one player, senior player at Arsenal. He said he kind of was probably doing about 50 interviews a year. And it's just very, you know, if you add up all the post-match and, you know, the stuff that is mandated by the broadcasters, and, you know, suddenly just doing things on a more ad hoc basis, it's hard, especially, you know, at the biggest clubs where there is such interest. So I really empathise with clubs that are get annoyed when people like myself just go, oh, can I have an hour to sit down with one of your players, please, for a long form written piece. Having said that, I think, you know, there is great value in us knowing a bit more about these players, considering the environment that you know, considering the conversations that surround them. I think, you know, it doesn't always have to be done through an interview, but it was amazing how quickly the conversation about Mustafi changed. Was it a year ago when he found platforms in which to express some of the difficulties he's had and how conscious he is of how he's been a, or how he was a bit of a running joke at Arsenal? And I think humanizing the players, giving them an opportunity and a platform to tell stories at real length outside of the context of we're just focused on this upcoming game. I think that has enormous value. Some clubs see that more than others. You know, within the work I do, we find that a club like Lothar's Amtset, a club like Tottenham, really do understand the value of giving their players platforms to share their stories, to humanize themselves. And I think you probably then build a deeper bond between supporters and players. I know that it's only, you know, a bit of written text or a video or whatever that is tomorrow's chip paper, but these things stay with people. People, you know, if a player is able to speak well and speak honestly, it really does change the view of them. And I think that has been really true of Hector Bellerin, who obviously has used pretty much every avenue available to him to engage with Arsenal fans. You know, he engages with them directly. The documentary series I thought was fantastic. Mm. He's done interviews as well and all of that. And I think it gives people a really different insight into who a player is and maybe changes their view of them and brings a bit more understanding. And yeah, I don't see how it can hurt. I'm sympathetic to clubs' needs and clubs' own media needs, but I do think it would be much better. I think particularly in the pandemic, we're hearing less and less. You know, there's fewer opportunities to talk to players, and when they are, they can be a little bit, you know, formulaic over Zoom. And I do hope that post pandemic, there's sort of maybe a bit of a reassessment of the value that comes with sitting down and chatting to journalists. Because I'm not in the business of tripping anyone up, and I hate doing that. It's more hassle than it's worth, because I just get loads and loads of angry phone calls and tweets.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's not, you know, look, I'm sure there are people out there who enjoy that kind of thing, but like, for the most part, you just want to get something interesting that you don't normally get in sort of interview situations. I think it's a really good point as well that you make about Hector Bellerin, for example, and you know, Arsenal players, many of them are active on social media, so they do have their own platforms to kind of humanize themselves with fans. You know, there are some which feel more natural than others. You know what I mean? In terms of like how cultivated the social media experience is, like what you get, is this a true reflection of the player, or is this is the image that we want to present? You know, I think that's natural anyway, but yeah, quite how clubs might look at those kind of platforms in the future is going to be interesting, particularly with younger generations who, you know, are more than used to spending all their time online, who don't really mind broadcasting their life as much as they do. Whereas I think with some senior players, for example, that wouldn't be the case. But anyway, look, interesting, interesting aspect of your job and what we get as fans and what we are allowed to see by clubs and players and everything else. And, you know, maybe we might see a bit more if the Madison thing is might open up some players' minds to being a bit more forthright or going off script a little bit. Then I think we'd all be beneficial or all be benefiting from that. So, look, let's move on and talk a bit about Arsenal, because there's a fair bit going on. We'll get to form in a few moments' time, but this week we've seen two players depart the club. Well, the Mesut Ozil thing isn't fully official yet because he's quarantining in Turkey, and I think as soon as that is done, that deal is going to be announced, his move to Fenerbahce. Sokratis was let go, or his contract was terminated. An early termination was agreed. It sounded very amicable, in fairness, in terms of the way it was presented. It sounded like it was something which player and club were both quite happy to do. When it comes to trimming the squad, which has been a big part of what we need to do, how have you viewed the work that has been done so far this month?
I mean, you don't want to get carried away, because you know, with two of those senior players, Arsenal have paid them. I can't confirm how much of what they were owed they paid them, but they've basically paid them to go away.
Yeah, I mean, they would have had to pay them anyway, though. I mean, I see that angle. It's like, okay, we used to let players go for free. Now we're actively paying them to go away, which is one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, of course, we would have had to pay them until June anyway. So whether there are any savings or not, I'm not really sure. You know, I don't know that we can say with any certainty that we've, you know, got ourselves a bargain. We've knocked off £1 million here or there because of an early termination or because we're paying them a lump sum. Maybe there is. But, you know, we would have had to pay them anyway.
Yeah, indeed. I think if nothing else, set that to one side, you've got a squad that you can kind of manage a little bit and that is about the right size. It still feels a bit big, especially in central defence. I think if those defenders were consistently fit, you would look at it and go, oh, that's still much too many. I'm looking at the squad now. It's 6 centre-backs. That feels like at least one too many. And you've got Tierney that can drop in. And I think ideally, maybe you'd want to swap one of those out for a left back. It was interesting that Arteta said, well, we might look at a new left back, but we might be fine anyway. We've got Ainsley and Cedric and Bakayo. I was more impressed with the Saliba and Kolasinac deals, in terms of getting them done quickly, because we knew there would be a market for those two players. I think, you know, whether Saliba is better off in France or England, we don't know yet, but he's playing regularly and that's the most important thing. I think one of the fears was that if you send someone like Saliba to the Championship and they're at a team like Norwich and they make a slow start, suddenly, you know, the pressure of promotion, and we saw this with Nketiah, that the pressure of promotion is such that you go, I'm sorry, Arsenal, we don't have the time to develop Saliba for you. You know, we've got to play our senior pros. And, you know, Nice are going to play him week in, week out. And I think that's the key thing. So, yeah, I think it's been a good job well done. I think there's a important to not get carried away that most of these players are not exactly recouping big fees. But it's also just clearing the deck of things, you know, things that Edu and Arteta don't need to worry about. And can focus on other things, Eddie can focus on incomings and rebalancing the squad, and Arteta can do a bit more coaching without having to, man manage the players he wants there in the short, medium and long term. So I think credit to them that it's 3 week, you know, there's still 10 days left of the window, and it's pretty much all done in terms of outgoings from the sounds of it. Certainly I've been told that Mustafi, pretty much everything's on the cards. He may even stay beyond the summer, but we'll see about that.
What?
He might do. Nothing has been ruled out, is what I would say. But I don't.
Right.
So, you know, he's open to it. I think, you know, I don't think it will happen, but it's not been ruled out.
Wow. It should be, to be fair. It should be, because, you know, look, he's not playing. He's not even making the squad. So, you know, it's about knowing when, what's the old Kenny Rogers song? Got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them. The Gambit, that kind of thing.
Before this gets, you know, sort of aggregated into all hell, you know, it's still overwhelmingly likely that he will, you know, leave as a free agent. But what I'm saying is he's not been told that's what's, you know, he's not been told.
Sure, okay. And you know, there haven't been the concerted efforts to move him on in January that there have been with other players. Because I think he did address this in his press conference last week, Arteta. He was asked about Mustafi. And I think what he's looking at is, you know, he's got Gabriel, he's got Pablo Marie, he's got Rob Holding, he's got David Luiz, he's got Callum Chambers, who he spoke well about today in his press conference, but who, you know, hasn't really played a great deal since his cruciate ligament injury. He may play in the FA Cup this weekend, who knows, but maybe Mustafi is a kind of insurance. You know, because look, Luiz could end up getting a suspension or an injury, and Pablo Marie is a little bit injury prone as far as we can see. He came in, did well, but he has had some significant spells out with injury since he joined. I don't think he's got into double figures yet in appearances, you know. So, yeah, I mean, he could be a sort of insurance policy centre half between now and the end of the season. It'd be mad if he stayed. It would just be crazy. I can't believe that, but
it would be really weird.
It would.
This is Arsenal.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about... actually, I had a question there about Edu, that I was going to ask you, because, you know, we're looking at this squad and we're looking at a... is firefighting the right way? Look, they're cleaning up a mess.
Mm.
They are cleaning up a mess. And I'm not really sort of apportioning any kind of blame here in terms of how we got to where we are. Let's just accept that's where we are, and it's a mess that needs to be cleaned up. Sanjehi was let go. And, yeah, and you know, at the time, there's obviously a very close association between Sanjehi and Edu and Kia Jarabchian, over whom there were many questions about, you know, his proximity to the boardroom, if you like, to the executive level of the club. So in some ways, I think we're asking one of the guys who made the mess to kind of tidy up the mess a bit. I'm not saying jury's out, but he really does have quite a lot to prove, I think, to sort of distance himself from the situation that we found ourselves in, and to show that he is somebody who is capable of putting in place a strategy to build this squad to where it needs to be. Trim the fat, trim some of the players who just aren't quite going to do it, replace them with better players who can take the team forward as well. I mean, where do you stand on that situation? I mean, do you think Edu might consider himself a little bit fortunate to be where he is without being damned by that association previously? You know, if not by fans, by the ownership at least. It's an interesting situation to consider.
It is a really hard one, and I think that the truth for Edu is this: you know, his whatever signings he makes in the future, the Jarabchian thing will not go away until Willian goes away. Without wishing to put too blunt a point on it, you know, that is the sort of for me, Willian is proof that, you know, Edu took the reins and he didn't really do anything differently to what had been going wrong in the first place, which is he signed players that were short-term gambles of, we desperately need to get back in the Champions League. You know, this guy, this older guy might be the one to do it. You know, you can even, if you're cynical, throw Thomas Partey into the mix. He looks like he's fantastic right now, and maybe that's all that matters. But, you know, he is... what Arsenal have needed for a very long time is a squad builder, and they've had people that are, you know, fixing problems, patching holes in this sinking ship in the hope it can just sort of about sail to top four and then everything will be fine.
Yeah, we need to dry dock, repair the hull, hoist the mainsail, et cetera, and get back out in the ocean again.
Yes, exactly that. I think so much of this has been short-term thinking, and... it's hard because Edu has been operating in really difficult circumstances, but he does have a huge amount to prove going into next summer and the summer after, assuming he gets to the summer after. I mean, there's no indication he won't. In terms of investing in a squad in the right way, I look at, you know, some of the teams that are above Arsenal in the Premier League. You know, Leicester is a great example, Aston Villa as well, how their executive team has really gradually built this squad of players that are all, you know, sellable assets if you want to sell them and you'd get huge money for them, or they are the core of a really strong team. And what Sanjehi and Edu have built from, you know, pretty shaky foundations, it must be said, is nothing. You know, so it's a house that can sort of blow down quite easily. You know, most of the building blocks that they have were already at the club when they arrived. You know, they were either young players like Saka, you know, or the players like Aubameyang. The only ones you might say are real unqualified successes are Gabriel and Tierney. And Gabriel, you know, is only half a season. So I think, you know, there's a huge amount to prove in terms of doing probably the hardest job in football, which is, you know, remodeling a squad, selling and making hard decisions on who to sell, who to move on, who to just give up on. I thought it was really interesting that West Ham just gave up on Haller, took nothing for him. There is one very expensive player in this squad that I think this summer a reckoning might be coming for Nicolas Pepe on what can we get for him now and is it worth taking what can be found. That's a tough job, and the thing is, we don't know that Edu, we've got nothing to go on that Edu can do it before. I know people say, you know, he's done this job in Corinthians, but and he's done a job at Brazil, but neither of them are remotely comparable to what he's doing with Arsenal, you know, an Arsenal on the decline. It's a hard job, and I don't know if he's up to it. I've not seen the evidence that he is.
Yeah, I mean, same. I mean, I agree with that. I don't know how we can properly assess his capability of doing the job without... Look, if you want to be really kind, you can separate the Sanjehi year and a half from him, if you want to be really kind, and say, okay, what we do in this January window and how we remodel and reshape the squad come the summer will be a good way for us to assess his proficiency or capability of doing this job. Because, you know, we can all, but like, I'm not saying these situations were easy in any way, but it's not complicated to do a deal or to make the decision, rather, that two guys who haven't been in your squad all season should go. So Ozil and Socrates, they haven't been in the squad. They weren't going to be in the squad. What do we do? Let them hang around, or do we move them on? I mean, that's kind of easy in terms of decision-making. You know, similarly with Saliba having absolutely fucked up the loan back to Saint-Étienne at the end of the last transfer window, like, the easy thing is to send him on loan in January if you're not going to make him part of the squad and you want him to go out and you want him to play and you want him to develop so he can become the player that Arsenal spent such a lot of money on in the future. That's easy. It's when you get to the summer and you look at, okay, how do you actually build the squad in every position? When you've got Luiz going, Mustafi going, you've got Dani Ceballos probably going, Kolasinac will be back and you're probably going to have to get rid of him again. Callum Chambers, decision-making time because he's got 12 months left on his deal. Elneny, 12 months left on his deal. Lacazette, 12 months left on his deal. Nketiah, 12 months left on his deal. There don't appear to be any efforts being made to extend those deals. And I'm not saying that's right or I'm not saying that's wrong, but it means that when you get to the summer, you have to make the decisions. So should you sell them and bring in the money and reinvest the money? Yes, probably. But then it becomes complicated because who are you targeting? Who are you going to bring in? How are you going to deal with the homegrown situation? All of those things are aspects that they are going to have to deal with when it comes to the summer. So, you know, how good he and Arteta are together, along with Dickie Garlick, whenever he comes in and whatever he's going to add to the team. What was he? Director of football at the Premier League?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I don't really understand it. I think he was sort of, a lot of it was kind of best practice stuff across the league.
Right.
But I think he'd done a very similar job to what he has done now he did at West Brom, and he did it quite well by all accounts.
Did he though? I mean, sorry, I'm not. I'm asking you here. I'm not.
Yeah.
Actually, being funny or trying to cast doubt on it. I just don't have any idea what he did at West Brom in terms of, you know, squad building or how he dealt with contracts and all those kind of things.
It's always a different. It's very different at a club like West Brom because. There you have to, you're basically, as a contracts manager, you're making sure you retain the flexibility of getting relegated. And that, you know, if you get relegated, that's not the contract manager's fault. And I think they did get relegated on his watch. But I remember at the time, and, you know, kind of seen since, that they were very reluctant to lose him, made him a new offer to stay. I think, obviously, you know, moving up to a Premier League job from West Brom, it's not, you know, the hardest job to make. But I think... it was kind of obvious that, you know, even when they went down, they were a well-run club. And I think a lot of that does come down to people like Garlick who keep things ticking over, who keep the key players tied down and, you know, make sure that you haven't got huge wages that, you know, dog you into the Championship. And I think for the most part, West Brom did that pretty well. There's always the odd error in there, but that's why they kind of were able to become a yo-yo team, because they kept the books in good condition.
Right. So, yeah. So look, summer will be the time when we can make despite whatever reservations we may each have, personally, individually, about how good he could be or how capable he is of doing what is, I think you've said, a very difficult job. And I think everyone can acknowledge it's a difficult job because we put ourselves in positions which are really difficult to manage. You know, you could argue that, you know, the Willian thing is a classic example of a club not learning any lessons from the deals that it has done in the past. But it is what it is right now, and how we deal with that and other situations will be very interesting. I want to ask you a bit about Emile Smith-Rowe and his emergence into this team. I know he's a player that you like, and you've spoken about his talent and potential in the past. Have you been pleasantly surprised at just how impactful he has been since he arrived into the team, and how in such a very short space of time he has completely changed the conversation about what the team, not necessarily what the team needs, but maybe what the club needs to do in the transfer market in the January window, if anything? Because, you know, before he played that game against Chelsea and did so well, and then subsequently has had such a significant impact and positive impact on the way the team has played and performed, and his own individual performances have been great. Everybody was looking at January as a time for Arsenal to address the creative midfield issue in the market. I mean, I think there's still a need to protect Smith Rowe. And I say that, you know, on two levels. One, protect him physically, because he can't play every game between now and the end of the season. He just can't. It's not realistic. It's unfair to expect him to carry that kind of a burden. But I think the other aspect of what we have to do is protect his potential and protect his development in such a way that you don't go and buy a player who is going to completely scupper his chances of playing. So it's a tricky one. It's a balancing act. You know, find a player who can come in and compete with him, but let's not put a gigantic wall in the way of his path to first team football.
Yeah, I mean, just on the first bit. So as you say, I'm a real fan of Emile's. I've tracked his career for a while, interviewed him a few times. I was stunned that he managed to make a success out of this. This is not a criticism. Well, no, it is a criticism of Arteta. Arteta threw him in at the deep end. It was very much I've got nothing else here. I don't think Arteta was at risk of getting sacked there, but I think he was at risk of running out of ideas and, you know, it becoming impossible to keep him around. And, you know, through Smith Rowe in at the deep end, and he was fantastic and has largely been very good to excellent ever since. I knew the talent was there, and I think everyone that seen him knew that the talent was there, but it's a tough position to play. And I know he relishes the responsibility of a whole team's game being in his hands, and he works, he presses like nobody's business. I mean, the whole conversation of, oh, Arsenal have needed a number 10 all along. Well, yeah, that's true, but they need a number 10 that works off the ball. And he and Martinelli, they instigate that press. And you saw Lacazette was pressing with more intensity. Aubameyang does it. I mean, you know, Saka would do it anyway. And suddenly it's a snapping animal at the head of the attack. And I think that's great. It's a great challenge, but it is a challenge how you manage Smith Rowe both over the next 6 months and longer term, because he's a good player already, but he's not ready. If there's 30 games left, you would want him to play between 15 and 20 as a starter, I would say. So, and then next season, you probably still don't know if he's ready to be your long term starting number 10 or starting, you know, as one of the two eights. And that's going to be a challenge in terms of not squashing his potential and never finding out because you bought Ødegaard or Sabitzer or Buendia or whoever it sounds like Ødegaard, the Ødegaard deal may be a really shrewd one in terms of he's also young, so you're not going to end up waste. If you do, if the worst comes to the worst and Smith Rowe doesn't make it, well, hopefully at least you've developed another top quality young talent. Ideally one you don't send back to Real Madrid after 6 months, but we shall see on that. I think right now the most valuable thing for him is being able to focus purely on things on the pitch. I know that there'll be talk about we've got to reward this guy for his improved form. We've got to give him a new long-term contract. From what I've heard, there's no intention from Smith Rowe to sit down until the end of the season. And that's solely so he can, so he can focus on football. I think when the conversations happen, they will pretty quickly lead to a new contract. Although Kevin De Bruyne will be 31 by the time Smith Rowe's contract
expires. Stop it.
But he will. He's a smart guy who will not rush into things and will not allow his head to be turned by contract negotiations when Arsenal need him to be fully focused. He's great. I think he's a real advertisement for what Haaland does with players. He worked so hard, and they encouraged him to work so hard on his pressing. He's always had the creative gifts. He's always been able to beat players with his dribbling and with his passing. But the last few years he has worked really hard to become what you need to be to play that position in the modern world. And he's great. And everyone at the club, I think, is over the moon that he's come in as the solution. And saved them having to just get absolutely fleeced in the January window by just with a desperate need for a 10. They can do this in a smart way. You need to get someone, but they don't have to be someone that starts every game. If it's a Denis Suarez alike,
a fit
maybe
one,
a little bit
maybe
better than Denis Suarez.
A fit one,
just steps in every once in a while. That would almost be ideal, and you do get time to look at Smith Rowe. He's outstanding, and I'm really chuffed for him.
What is Denis Suarez doing at this moment in time? I wonder. he's playing for Celta Vigo, so there you go. Look, I see what you're talking about there, and I think as well. Look, I see where you're coming from with being thrown into the deep end. I suppose playing devil's advocate just a little bit, there was, the fitness issue that he had for most of the season, which meant he wasn't available, which meant he couldn't play in the Europa League group stages too much, games in which he probably could have flourished and shown that he was ready to make the step up to first team football as and when he was needed. And I think as well, we have to acknowledge, sometimes shit can just line up for a player in that, look, Willian has been terrible. Nicolas Pepe hasn't been much better. There were injuries. There were suspensions. There were other things going on. I mean, I remember way back in the day, there was no question really of Ashley Cole being brought through as long as Silvinho was there. And then they discovered that Silvinho's passport was made from, the back of a Kellogg's cornflakes packet and some, what was it they always used to use on Blue Peter? Double-sided sticky tape, whatever it was, and off he went, also to Celta Vigo, I think. And the door was open then for Ashley Cole to come into the team. So sometimes, there's an element of serendipity to how you get yourself into a team and, to see a player make the most of that opportunity is hugely promising, not least because, he's a Haaland boy and he's just really, really talented and exciting to watch and humble as his slightly less, eloquent post-match interview the other night showed, if we're comparing to James Maddison.
He was a 7 out of 10, wasn't
he? Yeah, he was.
He was 7.
Yeah, look, he did fine. He's young. He's really nervous. I don't know that he's done one of those before on Sky with, the voice in his ears and Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville firing questions at him. I thought he did really well, and it was nice to see a young player who's so humble and appreciative of his chance. So long may it continue. Final question.
I've just done that. I have to say, it's not the weirdest interview he's ever done because you remember when we were out in Washington for the tour?
Yes.
And were you at there was a fan event at the campus they were staying at, And after much pleading and prodding, Arsenal agreed to let me talk to Smith Rowe on the condition that we did it kind of as a walk and talk.
Right.
So we're walking through the back of this Washington hotel, through the kitchens and pretty much everywhere that Arsenal could take
like
their squad.
Like Goodfellas, like that scene when they're coming into the nightclub like in Goodfellas.
Yeah, there's me here just asking Emil, oh, you know, how's the injury? How good's it to be back? As he's like, what is this guy? I just want to get back to my hotel room. So I'd like to think maybe I warmed him up for Jamie Carragher.
Okay, fair enough. We'll give you that credit. Just final question then. The recent form, the 4 wins out of 5 in the Premier League, 1 draw, 5 clean sheets in a row in all competitions, you know, an FA Cup win over Newcastle, albeit in extra time. I think you would say par for the course when you're a club like Arsenal and you look at those fixtures and you look at the potential return in terms of points, et cetera, et cetera. Par for the course, but having come after such a terrible run, are you encouraged by some of the things that you're seeing? Obviously, the creative issue is addressed. I think there are signs, perhaps, that Aubameyang's getting back to something more like his best for various reasons. One, obviously, he's put the ball in the back of the net, but two, we're getting him the ball in positions, where he can put the ball in the back of the net rather than sort of hugging the touchline. I think the Palace game was an example of quite how it didn't work with Aubameyang. The return of Thomas Partey, defensive solidity, et cetera, et cetera. The upcoming schedule is much more difficult. I think everybody accepts that. I think the manager and the players are well aware of that themselves. But are there enough green shoots from what we've seen in the last few weeks to be encouraged or positive about what is to come? I mean, I think there are going to be some ups and downs in this next period because, you know, the opposition that we face, away games, Europa League, balancing all those things. I'm not saying it's going to be plain sailing, going back to our terrible boat metaphor, but, you know, I think there are enough signs to be encouraged, you know, that we've, if not turned the corner, we have the corner in sight and that we are capable of producing some decent performances and decent results from what lies ahead.
Yeah, I think the two things that I'm really encouraged by, and you're right that there's going to be tough moments in the coming month or so. But I think the two things to like are that he's able to play a 4-man defence without it looking a little bit light. And that 4-man defence doesn't have to be a specific quartet. I think it's been really encouraging to see Pablo Mari. It's hard to say prove the doubters wrong because we haven't really had much to doubt, but just prove his worth, however you want to describe it. And then for Luis to come in and be solid and for them to get these clean sheets without the player we would generally say is their best centre-back. And I think a lot of it does come down to good, solid protection from Xhaka, who's not been perfect in possession, but has been okay. And I think a lot of the players have been okay. And these players playing okay, it's not too bad. It should get you a few good wins. And then, Aubameyang, I think a lot of the issue was that he just was not getting the chances. I think it was Ollie Price-Bates tweeted something about, you know, his opportunities, and I looked at some numbers, which I'm desperately trying to get up here, but he was somewhere around 50th for touches in the final third per game before Christmas.
Right.
He's up to around the top 15 now. I may have those numbers a little bit wrong, but he's basically getting about 50% more touches in the final third every game. The thing with Aubameyang is he's never been a great finisher. He's not a Son or a Salah. He doesn't outperform, you know, the expected goals that come his way. He just gets in the positions he needs to a lot. Having said that, you can only get in those positions if you're getting the ball up the pitch quickly. And I think it's really, I think for me, the most encouraging part of the Newcastle game was seeing Partey thump through Newcastle's midfield with this brilliant, he has this brilliant combination of grace and just the power of like a bully that he's just like, well, you're not as good as me. I'm having the ball off you.
Yeah.
And then slip in Aubameyang. I think that is a great way to get the best out of Aubameyang. And Partey for me feels like he could be a really powerful addition for the second half of the season. we all get overexcited, don't we, when we see new signings, but I'm a bit giddy about Partey. He makes me giggle in a silly way, because he's just, there are games where he's so much better than everyone else on the in that midfield, especially against Newcastle. His players were just bouncing off him, and it's not just the power thing, which feels like a reductive stereotype. It's that it's real quality to go alongside that. And I think having that in the midfield, that's something they've not had in a very long time.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing more of him for sure.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog. And, you know, if he can raise the level of those around him in midfield, or dovetail with midfielders who perhaps have felt imperfect in terms of their partnerships with one another, if you can find the right partner in there, it will certainly help. You know, a properly functioning central midfield is really key to a consistent team. You know, it doesn't solve all the problems, but a lack of consistency is certainly one of the issues that we've had. So hopefully he can do that. Right, look, we better leave it there. James, I look forward to your Twitter mentions tomorrow when this comes out, when all the Arsenal aggregators say Skodran Mustafi set for a new Arsenal deal, in brackets, at James Benge. So good luck with that.
Yeah, I'm regretting that already.
Listen, pleasure as always to talk to you, and we'll catch up with you soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to James. You can find him on Twitter. He is at James Benge, at James Benge, and doing his thing for CBS. Now, two games in 3 days against Southampton means two away games as well, means that Mikel Arteta is going to have to rotate his squad. And it is an interesting one. Obviously, our record in the FA Cup over the last number of years has been fantastic. It's a tournament in which we have excelled. It was a big part of the success of last season. Well, it made up for how poor the league season was. And look, winning a trophy is a great achievement. I just wonder about this weekend and the game coming up on Tuesday, how Mikel Arteta is going to view these fixtures in his mind, if he could choose one to win. And I'm not saying it's as binary as this. Obviously, he'll be out to win both and wants to win both. But I just wonder, in the grand scheme of things, if he might think that the league game is the more important one, given that, you know, how do you measure a team? How do you measure how good a team is? Is it what they do in a cup competition? Look, it can be part of it, but I think when you're looking to truly measure a team, its progress, its development, it's what you do over 38 games in the league. And we have gone through a very difficult period. We've turned things around a little bit, and now, of course, it's going to get a bit more difficult I suspect that the league game is the one that, if you gave him a choice and made him choose between the two, it's the one that he would pick. I know that some people will say, well, look, the FA Cup, it's a route into Europe. This season, winning the FA Cup gets you into the Europa Conference League, not the Europa League proper. So it's not quite as weighty as it was last time around. And I think, you know, the guys that have done it in the league have put in a huge amount of effort. There is going to be some need to rotate and to rest and to ensure that the likes of Smith Rowe and Saka and Tierney, to an extent as well, aren't overburdened. I mean, Tierney had to miss one of the league games because we played him 120 minutes in an FA Cup game. I mean, this game on Saturday against Southampton could be a 120 minute game as well. So I'm looking at this one and thinking, I know Ainsley didn't do great left back in the last game, but it's an FA Cup game. I would give him another go there. I'd be looking at bringing in Pepe. I'd be looking at bringing in... I don't like it. I said this on the Arsecast Extra on Monday, but there is a need to extract some kind of value from Willian. I don't really want to see Willian, but I can understand why, if he's picked on Saturday, he will be picked, because we need to get the most out of the squad that we have, and players in bad form aren't going to turn around the bad form unless they get a chance to play. So, I accept it's not really a solution that anybody is particularly fond of, but if it happens on Saturday, there are reasons for it. You know, Gabriel could come back in at the back. I don't think we'd be playing Runarsson in goal. Thomas Partey, do you give him another 60 minutes? Do you drop him out and leave him on the bench to give him a few more minutes, because he is going to be so important in the league? My point overall is I think there is going to be a fair amount of rotation for the team on Saturday, which isn't to say that Arteta isn't taking the FA Cup seriously. I'm sure he does want to win the game, but he's also cognizant of the fact that we've got a league game in the same place in 3 days' time. So he's going to have to rest some players, simple as that. So we'll wait and see what happens. It's a relatively early kickoff on Saturday, I think. I have to look this up. I think it's a 12:30 kickoff, arsenal.com, not arsblog.com, for the fixtures. So it is, 12:15 on Saturday. It seems like an absolute age since we played a game that early, actually. Yeah, normally our games are afternoon or evening. It seems like that's been the case for most of this season anyway, so that's a little bit of a change. Fingers crossed we can do the business. James and I will be around on Monday, of course, to discuss whatever happens at St. Mary's and look ahead to what's going to happen at St. Mary's on Tuesday as well. For Patreon members, we will have a preview podcast for the league game. We're not going to preview FA Cup games. The preview podcasts are only for the league game, so you can join us for one of those on Monday as well. So a couple of podcast for you on Monday if you're a Patreon member, patreon.com/arsblog. In the meantime, I just thank you again for being here. Thanks for listening, for subscribing, for supporting, for all the comments and all the feedback. It's hugely appreciated. Hope you enjoyed the show. Have yourselves a great weekend. Fingers crossed Arsenal can do the business. Keep this good run going. Another clean sheet, some goals. That'd be nice. Make our weekend good, please, if you wouldn't mind, Arsenal. We'll catch you on the Arsecast Extra on Monday. So until then, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye. Fair point, Jamie. Well made. Now for some post-match reaction, it's Jimmy Anderson, and he's talking with Jeth Shroves. Jeth Shroves. Great game today, Jimmy. Well done. You've won the game. You scored a goal. How do you feel?
Yeah, obviously happy for the lads. You know, we got 3 points. That's the main thing. But how do I feel? Well, pretty much empty inside. At the end of the day, what does it all mean?
Well, it means that you're top of the table. You've now got a 3-point lead ahead of Man City and Liverpool, so that must feel good.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? You know, walking on a beach on a hot, sunny day, sand and sea beneath your toes, that feels good. Then you look out to the horizon and you think, wow, what is the point of any of this? The vastness of the ocean stretching out grey as far as the eye can see. You get lost in the hugeness of existence itself. Me, I'm just one tiny grain of sand on this beach that we call the universe. As Aristotle said, happiness depends upon ourselves. But what if we don't know who we really are inside? Is it then possible to be happy, even when you've scored a goal to take your team top of the league? Aristotle didn't have to deal with the pressures of top-flight football.
Well, tell me about the goal then. That's your 12th of the season. Quite a good record.
Yeah, well, great work down the right by Dave, and I hit the ball first time and there it was in the back of the net.
Jimmy, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jeff. Jess. Jeff. 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 Jeff.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.